Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. I am so excited and honored to welcome Melissa DeRosa to Leave Your Mark. For those of you listening, Melissa is a 20-year veteran of politics and government at the most senior level. She's a Democratic strategist living in New York City. And Melissa served as communications director, strategic advisor, chief of staff, and secretary, the first female secretary to Governor Cuomo. And she has this incredible history of just being this badass chick. And obviously a lot has changed over the course of her career, but she has a new book out, What's Left Unsaid. And Melissa, I'm so excited to reconnect with you at this point in your career, because what you've been able to do, what you've been through, and how you've now come out with this book, What's Left Unsaid, which you have a lot of things that are now said in this book, I'm excited to dig into it from the perspective of your professional life. So welcome to Leave Your Mark.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to see you on Zoom and reconnect with you. It's been years, but I'm such a big fan from afar and up close. So thank you for having me.
Oh my God, of course. So I think the funniest thing, when I started reading your book, I was like, wait, she started in fashion PR? Like what? Like that's unbelievable to me.
You know, it's so funny. I was having dinner with a friend on Saturday night, and we were talking about somebody else that we're both friends with who had sort of veered in one direction and then came back to where she was supposed to be all along. And I referenced that. And I sort of joked that I think that especially for people who grow up with parents who are professionally very successful and where your sort of interests lie, where your parents' interests lie, there's always a little bit of a detour. And so I refer to that period of time as like my phase of rebellion. And as I write in the book, literally, I was playing beer pong during senior week at Cornell University. And one of my really good guy friends, Spencer's sister, was the head of communications for Theory, which is the fashion brand Theory, of course. And she was telling me that she couldn't find a good press assistant and she was looking for someone. And I sort of raised my hand and we instantly connected. And then 2 weeks later, I was living in New York City working as a public relations person for fashion. So it was an unexpected stop, but I loved every minute of it.
Well, okay. So it is an interesting training ground considering where you ended up going, but this is the part that I laughed so hard. Your dad was basically, so for everyone listening, like my background is in fashion PR. So I'm reading Melissa's book and her dad is basically like, okay, that's like not a real job. Like you're not going to really do that. So he thought it was like embarrassing, basically,
well,
to have that.
Embarrassing. What he only would hear about is when we would go to dinner and I'd be like, oh, I was just at Bungalow 8. And oh, I was just at the opening of this really cool thing. And I suddenly wanted to buy really expensive clothing. And I became very fixated on Page Six and Vogue and all these different things. And so for him, he just heard fun. He was like, this feels like you just think that life is supposed to be fun. When in reality, as I write in the book, fashion is incredibly cutthroat. It is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's art. It's all of these different things that come together, business, marketing. And so it's so much more than that. But to my dad, he was like, this just feels like you're partying all the time.
I mean, I really did laugh so hard. Okay. So how did you go from fashion PR to politics? And I know that you grew up, obviously, tell a little bit about your parents. And I know that you grew up in that kind of household, but Charlotte.
Yeah, no. So I grew up, my father was always in politics from the time I was a little kid and I was fascinated by what he did. I write in the book that I was one of these like really nerdy kids that was watching Meet the Press when I was 10 years old. And I was reading the Daily News and the New York Post, the New York Times when I was 12. And I just had this fixation on politics because my dad was so fixated on it. And so I found it so fascinating. And when I was 16 years old, I asked him for help getting an internship. I interned for the political director for the AFL-CIO, which is the nation's largest union. And so I did that when I was 16 and I applied to Cornell from there in their School of Industrial and Labor Relations, which is really focused on collective bargaining and negotiating and labor movement. And so it was just something that, you know, one of those things. I grew up around it. I grew up immersed in it. I loved it. I was fascinated by it. And so that's why the fashion thing was especially funny, because it was like, since I was five, I was headed on this path. And then all of a sudden I'm 21 years old and I'm like, detour. which was great and wonderful. But my father was like, let's get you back on that other path.
Well, you certainly got back on that path and you were able to really rise pretty quickly, right?
Yeah. As I write in the book, when I was 26, I was Obama's New York State political director. At 28, I was deputy chief of staff to the attorney general of the state of New York. By 30, I was his chief of staff. And then Cuomo sort of poached me and I left the AG's office and went over to the governor's office. And so from there, I was communications director, strategic advisor, chief of staff. And then at 34, I was elevated to secretary to the governor, which for your viewers, listeners, is the equivalent of White House chief of staff. And I was the youngest ever and the first ever female to hold the position, which is crazy to think that it took until, you know, 2017 for a woman to hold that role in New York, a state as progressive as New York. But yeah, so that was the trajectory.
Did you feel the weight of that at all? Or were you just like, I've got this?
No, I mean, every minute of every day, which it really, as I write in the book, it really hit the peak during COVID. That was when it was more than, you know, can we get $15 minimum wage passed or dealing with a subway derailment or dealing with a hurricane. When COVID hit New York, and that was the weight of the world. And I write in the book about really feeling that. And in moments, you know, closing the door to my office and laying on the floor and crying in those quiet moments when I was alone. Because another thing was when I was growing up and I told my dad, you know, I want to do what you do. I want to be in politics. And back then, the 80s and the 90s, politics, government really was male dominated. The percentage of women that were involved, it was like 80, 20, 70, 30. And he said to me from the time I was a little girl, you know, if you want to succeed in this business as a woman, you're going to have to run faster, jump higher, and never let them see you sweat. And I really internalized that. And so the press, especially, I had this reputation for, you know, the Daily News wrote a piece on my wedding and referred to me as hard charging in a story about my wedding. They're like, DeRosa, the hard charging bride. But when you're a woman and you're in a male-dominated industry, it's like you're expected to never show any imperfections, never show any cracks. And so, you know, from the time I was a kid, when I decided I wanted to do this, like, that's what I did. I ran to the tape and passed the tape. I jumped as high as I was told to jump. I showed up first. I stayed there last. And I lived every moment of everything in my job like it was the most important thing, which made me very good at what I did, but also came with a lot of personal sacrifices.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. But I want to point out, just for everyone who's listening, in reality, and I'm quoting Vanity Fair right now, you were the most powerful unelected person in New York's state government. I mean, literally the right hand. And nothing became more obvious than when we started watching you both during COVID. And then all of a sudden, I think your whole persona must have just gone from like 0 to 5 million based on just the spotlight. So the first thing I want to ask is, you know, we talk about the difference between women and men in these very powerful positions, but there is this thing with women, like we always have to be likable. Like we have to be good at our job, but we have to be likable. And the hard charging, you know, there's been other comments that are like, oh, she has sharp elbows. Like, how do you see yourself in reality versus how everyone else sees your own personal brand?
Look, I think that, and I've said this in other interviews, no one is one thing. And that's sort of what the press does to anyone in public life, right? It's much easier to paint someone with a broad brush and everything is black or white and gray sort of gets lost in the middle. But, you know, look, I am a tough, you know, demanding. I didn't demand anything from anybody else that I wasn't willing to give myself. I was harder on myself than anyone else. But I demanded perfection. As I said, I was in early. I was there late. I had the tough conversations. I asked the difficult questions. I didn't shy away from confrontation. And, you know, look, people do things a different way. I was incredibly effective at what I did, and I own that. And yeah. I think women should own more of their success and not feel limited in saying, oh, well, I tried. No, I got it done. I got the job done. And not a lot of people could get the job done. In those press conferences, the thing that was so crazy was I was just sitting next to Andrew Cuomo the same way that I had been for 8 years. It's just that all of a sudden it was on a global stage. And so to your point, it was like 0 to 60 like that. And that was a bizarre transformation, going from sort of being the behind the scenes person that everyone in the press sort of knew and in the political world knew, but then going to being someone who was recognized on the street was a bizarre thing that I didn't ask for and I really didn't like. And so that was a very strange experience to go through.
For people who are listening to this who maybe are entrepreneurs or have corporate roles or are rising in the ranks, how would you advise women to channel your toughness and to make it the most productive it can be in their own jobs? Like, it is tricky, especially if people are in male-dominated corporate environments. There's a hierarchy, there's a pecking order. People don't want to step out of line, people don't want to be perceived the wrong way. Like, if you were rewinding on your career right now, what would you say you did really well in those moments to sort of make everyone around you respect you, even when you were being tough?
Well, I mean, listen, you have to lead from the front, right? So again, I never asked anyone to do anything I wouldn't do myself. I was the hardest working person in the room because I knew that if I was going to ask people to do certain things, I had to be willing to lead by example. The one thing when I look back on my rise and my tenure as Secretary of the Governor that I wish I had done differently was that I think at moments I lost my calibration, where I got so accustomed to fighting all the time. And, it's me versus the legislature, me versus the press, Democrats versus Republicans, whatever it was, that there are certain moments when I feel like looking back, I didn't realize you don't always have to have your foot on the gas. And so I think sort of recalibrating, and there are moments where a more effective strategy is you catch more flies with honey, and you have to be able to have the full range of both the personality and management style. And you can't get the most from people if they don't feel appreciated. And so that was another thing where it's even in those environments that are super demanding, 24 hours, high stress, high anxiety, you have to remember to say thank you. You have to remember to appreciate people and to know that everyone has that moment where they're going home to something that you have no idea what they're dealing with and living with, and showing each other a little bit of grace. And so I think it's sort of that wide range of management skill, which sometimes I was better at, and sometimes I wish I had been better at.
That's a really good insight. So it's funny because you came from an industry originally, fashion way back when, where a lot of people that I sort of grew up with in fashion really put their personal lives on hold until their 40s. They were 150% in that job. It was nonstop, 24/7. Your family and your friends were all the people in that industry. And personal lives, dating, marriage, kids was really not a priority
Yep.
until, maybe in some cases it was too late. You moved over to an industry that is also 24/7, right? And you personally suffered from it. Tell us a little bit about the sacrifices that you made.
It's funny. For so many years, I feel like I exclusively dated people that were in my world because, it's like the fluency of the same language.
They
It's really.
understand.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's hard when you're so committed to your job. It's hard to date somebody who doesn't understand exactly what you're going through. And so I actually ended up marrying somebody who I had worked with in the governor's office. I was actually his boss originally. I was comms director and he was press secretary. I talk about that in the book where he, one night asked me out and he said he wanted to be my boyfriend. And I was like, I'm your boss. And he went and got a legal opinion drawn up based on the public officer's law to show me that it wasn't against the rules and we weren't doing anything wrong. And it was like, how romantic.
That's so funny.
So pretty. But no, I mean, we ended up getting married and he left the governor's office and he went into the private sector. And all of a sudden, he had a lot more time and he had a lot more flexibility. And when we went on vacation, he wanted me to be present. And when we were at dinner, it was really suddenly irritating to him when I was stepping outside every 10 minutes to take a phone call. And that fluency of the same language was all of a sudden lost. I write in the book that we had this one blow up where I said to him, I don't understand. It's not like it was deceptive marketing. We met at work. I came as advertised. But circumstances changed and he wanted something else. And so I talk really intimately and personally in the book about my marriage and the disintegration of my marriage. And, you know, there's a whole other added layer to that dynamic where, because I was sort of a public facing person, because the press was so focused on me for so many years, not only was I struggling with a marriage that was falling apart, we were lying to everyone around us about it because we didn't want it to end up in page six. We didn't want to end up dealing with rumors or whatever. And so that adds an entire other level of anxiety and sort of shame to what you're going through and having to feel like you're projecting this person and this relationship that you aren't really. And so there was that piece of it. And then at the same time, I had understood, you know, from the time I took the job of secretary at age 34, that there was no chance I was going to have time for kids anytime while I was in that position. And so I talk in the book about the process of going and doing egg freezing. And the first appointment that I went to, being told that my AMH level was that of basically like a postmenopausal person.
I know. Sorry.
And, you know, it was, look, the reality is it's much more common than people think. It's just that we don't talk about it. And as a result of that, when you go through it, you feel so broken and so alone. And I think if we talked about it a little bit more openly and freely and people understood that it was more common, then they wouldn't feel so alone. And, you know, we would have each other to lean on. And so that's also part of why I was so honest and open in my book about these things, is because I wish when I was going through those things, I didn't feel like I needed to project what I saw in all these other professional women who I emulated, who I was around, you know what I mean? Because none of us is perfect. And I think the more we all sort of acknowledge that to one another, the better off we all are. And so, yeah, I mean, I dealt with divorce, I dealt with infidelity, I dealt with freezing eggs and infertility and all kinds of things that I get into in the book. And the reality is that now, being 41 years old and looking back, and it's a very strange thing to write a memoir at 40. Like, I would hope I have a lot more life left to live.
But you do, just part one is written.
But in looking back on all of it, you know, I don't think I would change any of it. I was lucky to be in the positions that I was, in the moments that I was in them. I got to step in and make sure that IVF is covered by insurance for women for whom it's medically necessary. During COVID, I was, you know, the person that said women are going to allowed to have a partner in the room when they're giving birth. I'm not allowing that not to happen in New York. $15 minimum wage. These things that I got to be there, and because I was there, make a real difference. And I think sacrificing the rest of it for that period of time sort of is what it is. And I just have high hopes for the future. Everything happens for a reason.
Yeah, I do believe that too. But I also think that when you're even trying to get pregnant or doing IVF, like, the stress level of your job was certainly not helping your cause, right? Yeah. When we talk about crisis, you dealt with, I mean, I forget the guy's name who said it. You were asking for some list in the book and he was like, oh, you mean that list when we have like the once in a lifetime global pandemic, that list where we were supposed to have that about, oh, the non-essential businesses.
Yeah, the non-essential businesses.
So it was actually funny. For everyone listening, Melissa's book is such a window into behind the scenes of just COVID and what was happening behind the scenes in the governor's office. It's an unbelievable education if you want to take that memory lane road back. But how, in your career, have you been able to manage the stress? I mean, is every day just one fire after the next? Did you ever have a breather? It just seems like nonstop. Like, what are your tactics?
Well, so, I mean, in that job, yes, it was every day was going from one fire to the next. And I write this in the book. It's interesting because I was in that job in the governor's office for 8.5 years. Whereas if you look at sort of high level roles, like in the White House, the shelf life of a White House chief of staff is something like 30 months. Like, no one goes longer than a little over 2 years. And there's a reason for that, because it is so intense every day. But, you know, for me, it was waking up every morning and going for a long run. And that was my opportunity to get my head straight. I had a great therapist for a lot of years who, like, while it wasn't consistent necessarily, like, I tried to make time for me. It was those sacred brunches on Sundays with my girlfriends where husbands and kids weren't allowed. You know, it's finding the things that are so irreplaceable and valuable to you that you feel like you're doing for yourself and not feeling selfish when you're leaning into those things and trying to the extent possible to put boundaries up around them. Like every morning when I woke up and I went for that run, I was like, nothing is going to stop me from going for this run. Like it is my me time. So finding whatever that thing is for you, that is your outlet, that is your you time, and protecting it and safeguarding it and leaning into it.
Yeah, I need to be better at that for sure. I promise Lead Your Mark will be right back after a quick message from our sponsor. Are you ready for more career advice? Welcome back to Lead Your Mark. So when you started on this global stage during the pandemic, I mean, a lot of really amazing things happened for you too. Like you were tapped by model Christy Turlington Burns to grace the cover of Harper's Bazaar in this incredible spread. Our mutual friend, Rebecca Minkoff, had you appear on a billboard in Times Square. Lots of amazing things going up, you know, that trajectory of like all these things happening. Did you notice like a change in your persona at that time? Were you like, oh my God, what is happening with my personal brand?
Well, so the Rebecca Minkoff billboard was actually a few years earlier, but the thing that was very strange during COVID when I was on the cover of Harper's and Time Style section did this big piece on me, and I was starting to get inundated with fan mail. Like the governor was getting inundated with like women who wanted to date him and these homosexuals and all this stuff. And like, that was expected in a way, right? Because he's the principal and that was what it was in the moment. What was so bizarre to me was that I started getting inundated with letters from women across the country, women in their 40s and 50s saying, oh my God, I respect you. I look up to you. Little girls saying, I want to be like you. Men saying, are you married? I want to date you. It's such a, such a bizarre thing because again, you know, Andrew Cuomo, pick a name of any elected official, even like female elected officials, Hillary Clinton, they make a choice, right? They put themselves out there. They put their name on a ballot. They invite you into their personal lives. They invite you to dissect every single thing about them. But when you're a staffer, it's sort of an unwritten rule. You're kind of exempt from that, except at very high levels in national positions. And so all of a sudden, it was this bizarre thing where, you know, people are like wanting to know who's making my dresses and wanting to know what shade my lipstick was. And it was also just a strange thing as a woman, right? Because people don't ask those things of men. You know, like this woman did this whole blog on the jewelry I was wearing at press conference. It was just a bizarre thing. And it was funny because when I decided to do the book, I decided that I was going to be really personal and really open and really honest. And when I was talking to my family about it, and they're like, are you really sure you want to do this? And I was like, look, it's already been done. It was taken away from me, right? Like it was done without my permission. I became sort of this person that was constantly in the tabloids and constantly in the media. And it wasn't with my consent necessarily. So now that I'm here, I'm going to take my story back, stop letting other people tell my story for me. But yeah, it was certainly a bizarre transformation. And I don't know that I ever recognized that there was any brand element to it. It was just more all of a sudden, it was like I was recognized. Like it's a very crazy thing to sit in a New York City restaurant and have someone say, are you Melissa DeRosa? Can I take a photo with you? And I'm like, I'm sorry, what? What planet am I on? It was just, it was a very strange period of time.
Listen, you're selling my book now too, because in On Brand, I mean, the first subtitle is Shape Your Narrative. And the reason you do that is so people don't make up their own version of your story.
Yep.
So obviously things changed, right? And we went from these everyday briefings and feeling like, I don't know. I don't know if Andrew Cuomo was our father or whatever, like a father figure of like dependence. And you were right there by his side. And then all of a sudden, it just like a light switch went off and everything changed. You resigned from the Cuomo administration August 8th, 2021. And I guess one of the things that was very poignant to me, and you are not shy in this book as far as talking about President Biden and everyone who is sort of involved in, I guess, the demise of what was the governor's office. And one of the things that I thought was crazy is that when President Biden asked Cuomo to step down, he hadn't read the report.
Yep. He didn't read the report. I mean, none of the elected officials read the report. And Biden wasn't shy about it. He said it on national television. He said, I didn't read the report. But, you know, Biden, and I get into this in the book pretty in depth about the hypocrisy and the politicalization and the weaponization of the Me Too movement, which is Biden had his own baggage. He had been accused by Tara Reid and a number of other women of inappropriate conduct. And there's sort of this moment where I think he knew that if he wasn't aggressive quickly, that the press would flip on him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became, you know, cover your ass, protect yourself first and foremost. But nobody read that report. I mean, the press didn't read that report. The number of people who have read my book and have sent me emails and letters and saying, I can't believe that's what happened.
And it's it's mind-blowing. And I think one of the things that I am so impressed by, when the shit hits the fan and it hit hard, It is so easy for people to say, oh, you better remove yourself from that situation. You should disassociate. You better, you know, make it like you are no longer an ally of Andrew Cuomo.
Yep.
But you went the total opposite, The total opposite, standing by him at a time when, you know, we're in this very weird Me Too is so extreme in some cases. In other cases, we see it the opposite way right now with what's happening with Israeli women. And I guess my question is, when you had that defining moment where you were like, I am standing by his side, what was your thought process there?
I mean, look, I know him. I know him. I know his family. I worked side by side with him for 8.5 years. I lived in the governor's mansion during the height of COVID with a bunch of other staff. And I just refused to let myself be gaslit, and I refused to let myself be bullied. And that's what was going on. I was being bullied by people like Rebecca Traister, New York Magazine, by, you know, certain accusers, by certain members of the media. And I was like, I know who I am. I know who he is. I know the truth. And you know what? If God forbid I was ever on the receiving end of this, I would hope that people who knew me and who worked with me and who believed in me wouldn't cut and run either. And it wasn't loyal to a fault. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to stand beside this horrible person no matter what because I'm loyal. It was because I could see through the bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in those moments, people, there's a tendency to get so afraid to cut and run, to try to do what's best for you in that minute, you know, without looking to the long term and believing that sort of the truth will out and these different things. And it's just not how I was raised. You know, I stuck by my principles. I stood with my friends. I stood with him. I believed in him to this day. I mean, I think as time has gone on, 5 district attorneys looked at their report. Every single one said there's no there. You know, when people read my book and they're like, wait, 11 women, you're saying that like 3 of them were a kiss on the cheek? Really? That's why the guy had to resign? It was a moment of hysteria and a stampede. And I just said to myself, I'm not going to allow myself to give into it.
It's so impressive and so admirable. And I think that having the strength to do that is very rare under that intense pressure. It's interesting, though. Did you ever see Gwyneth Paltrow's Sliding Doors, that movie?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So if people haven't seen it, it's like she's waiting for this train and she has a choice. She can get on, get off, and her entire life changes. So you almost left your job in 2020 to join the Biden campaign.
Yep.
But you chose to stay. Do you ever think about what your life would have been like?
All the time. In the summer of 2020, you know, we had these sort of protracted conversations with the Biden administration, who we were really close with, a lot of the top people, about the potential of my leaving Cuomo and going over for that last final sprint, which if I had done that, I likely would have stayed and gone into the administration. And I mean, as it was, I was asked to serve on the transition committee for the president, serving as, you know, top advisor on their COVID response. I think all the time about how different would life have been for everyone if I had gone in August of 2020, and I had, you know, stepped out and gone a totally different direction. At the same time, in August 2020, the reason I didn't leave was because we were still dealing with COVID in New York. And I remember at the time being like, where can I do the most good for the greatest amount of people? And unquestionably, it was being in that chair during those moments. And if I hadn't been there for the fall and the second wave, and if I hadn't been there for the vaccine rollout, I don't know that I would have forgiven myself for that either, if some things had gone wrong or the governor didn't have the right team in place or the support it needed. So, you know, it's a catch-22 and I'll never know, but I certainly think about it.
So you put all of this and so much more in your book, What's Left Unsaid, My Life at the Center of Power, Politics, and Crisis. There's so much in it, but what do you think is the just bottom line takeaway you want people to know or to feel after reading your book?
I want people to feel that in life, sometimes you get knocked down, a divorce, infertility, something happens in your job, scandal, something happens in the press, you lose a family member, whatever it is, you got to get back up and keep going. And no matter how horrible it feels in that moment, and no matter how low it feels, there is a tomorrow and you can come back and you can come back so much stronger, and you just have to keep fighting. And if there's one message I hope people take from the book, it's I'm still here. I'm going, I'm thriving, I've never been happier. And there were moments that were really low for a lot of different reasons throughout that book, personally, professionally, in the media, all these different things. And you just keep going and you keep fighting. And as long as you keep that resilience and that fighting spirit, it's going to get better. So that's what I hope people take.
What did you learn about yourself in actually the writing process? Like, was there anything that you were like, wow, I didn't even think of that at the time?
Forcing yourself to live through difficult moments, sort of closing your eyes and bringing yourself back there, and sometimes having a really good cry, like so cathartic, so helpful in processing, so helpful in moving forward and sort of reorienting and reordering your thoughts, especially when you go through something traumatic or a period of time that's high anxiety, high stress. And so I just endorse it across the board, whether if it's just for you or if it's for something you want to publish. There were certain scenes of that book that I waited until the very end to write, like the scene where I talk about Matt, my ex-husband, and I talking about getting divorced. That was one of the last scenes I wrote for the book. And I was down in Puerto Rico by myself, literally looking at the ocean, and I closed my eyes and just started typing. Like, I took myself back to that moment and just started typing, and like tears streaming down my face. And I like pushed through that scene. There's nothing in the world like it at the end of it, feeling like, okay, I did it. I forced myself to confront it. I relived it. I put it on paper, and like now I can turn the page. And so I so endorse the writing process.
You know, we have the same publisher, Union Square.
I do. So great.
So great. We're like twins. What are you excited about right now?
You know, the unknown. And like, that's exciting to me, is that I don't know what's next. I've just started doing some TV commentary. I've been writing a column for the Daily Beast. I'm about to start picking that up again. I'm like advising for some fun clients. There's a bunch of irons I have in the fire and different fronts. And if I hadn't gone through what I went through, I'm not sure any of those doors would have opened or I would have explored these different paths. And I'm sort of at a stage in my life where I'm telling myself I'm not saying no to anything and just try a little bit of everything and see what fits. And I think that's most exciting.
I love it. So the last question of my show is always the same. It's, how do you want to leave your mark? And yeah, how do you want to leave your mark, Melissa?
I want to leave my, I mean, look, public service is where you can do the greatest good for the most number of people. And I feel so fortunate that I got to play a role in things like the things we talked about, IVF, $50 minimum wage, paid family leave. And I hope that moving forward, I figure out a way to continue to leave a mark on this state and this country. It's positive for women and for families for years to come.
I love it. Melissa, thank you so much. This book is outrageously good. Page Turner beyond. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I'll see you Thursday.
You certainly will.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Leave Your Mark. Leave Your Mark is a production of Leave Your Mark LLC and Money News Network. I'm your host, Aliza Licht, and if you want to learn more about how you can work with me or book my services, go to alizalicht.com. Don't forget to pick up a copy of my best-selling career advice book, Leave Your Mark, and my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception. Truly everything you need to build your personal brand or change the way people think about you. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.